She sure has a sense for the dramatic. And then says softly, a seed.
But that's easy, Mira says with a laugh. We can just...
She breaks off, remembering where she is.
No seeds, my dear,
Flame tells her. Not a single picking seed in this sterile place. Lachlan and I exchange a look with sinking hearts. I could have taken a seed, he says numbly. I plucked a flower, and I could just as easily have taken a seed. If only we'd known, I say. It doesn't seem fair. The one thing we need to save Eden is found in abundance just a few miles away.
We could cross the desert again,
Carnelian suggests. Lachlan just barely survived, I say. What are the odds any of us would survive a round trip? Then I have a thought. The camphor tree. It must have made seeds, right?
We thought of that, Flame says. We managed to get a team into the wreckage, but there was absolutely nothing organic left.
None of the second children who lived in the underground preserved a seed?
We tracked down everyone we could. No one has one.
It was considered disrespectful to take a seed, Lachlan explained.
We didn't have the resources to propagate another tree, so any seeds it made were destroyed.
Then it's hopeless, Mom says. We're all silent for a moment, envisioning the likely future. In time, the center will send its forces against the holdouts in the outermost circle. The rebels will put up a brave fight, but the center has the numbers, the firepower. They might try to preserve life at first, but when that becomes too costly, they'll simply bomb or gas the outermost circle and rebuild later. Or they'll find a way to shut down Flame's dead zones, so anyone who hasn't gotten surgery to remove the lenses will revert to being a placid, indifferent zombie. It's a grim future, but I don't see any realistic alternative. We brainstorm about plausible solutions, but come up with nothing. I feel so powerless, I murmur to Lachlan.
So stupid, you mean?
Yarrow interjects. I rushed in here without really thinking, just charging forward, and somehow I thought that if I just acted decisively, everything would somehow fall into place. That once I made the choice to do this, to be brave instead of safe and comfortable, I'd have an opportunity to help everyone here.
Like I said, stupid, and you dragged everyone else into your stupidity. So you better get on the ball and start doing a better job. Why don't you stop feeling sorry for yourself and think for a minute? I could tell you.
I shut her up as well as I can, focusing on Lachlan instead of the other me in my head.
You found your brother, Lachlan points out.
I look lovingly at Ash across the room, where he's leaning close to Angel, arguing quietly about something.
I know, and that's amazing. But there's always something more to do. I have to find out what happened to Lark.
I see a fleeting look of discomfort cross his face. And even if she is alive, even if I save her, how can I say I've done enough? The second children are still in danger. All of Eden is virtually under a spell. I'm just one person, but there has to be something more I can do.
Until we find a seed, there's not much we can do, Lachlan says.
Except hold our territory and be ready to fight, my dad says as he walks over to us. Young man, he says to Lachlan, clapping a hand on his shoulder, with this weird paternalism I've never seen before. If you can spare my lovely daughter for a while, I'd like to take her on a tour of our rebel circle.
I stare at him. He's acting just like a real dad, which is a completely new thing to me. It's kind of embarrassing.
What's next? Is he going to ask Lachlan whether his intentions toward his daughter are honorable?
Of course, sir,
Lachlan says. And I giggle when his voice squeaks a little on the sir. He and I exchange amused looks to suddenly be in these conventional roles
of protective father, pursued daughter, and suitor. We'll meet for dinner tonight, Flame says as we leave. Before sundown, we eat before dark to conserve power.
Yeah, Ash says. If there's a choice between a nightlight and having enough power to keep Flame's disruptors going so we can all think straight, I know which one I'm choosing.
Are you coming with us, Ash? I ask eagerly. Now that I've found him, I don't want to let him out of my sight. To my surprise, though, he declines.
I have some things I need to talk about with Angel. Provisioning matters. Anyway, I'm sure you and Dad have a lot to talk about.
A little hurt, I say.
Okay, I'll see you at dinner then.
And set off into the outermost circle with my dad to see the rebel stronghold. Mom gives me an encouraging thumbs up as I leave. Does she really think we can have a normal family? I can tell Dad is uncomfortable as he walks by my side through the streets. He keeps up a steady stream of descriptive, one-sided conversation, telling me about the rebels.
The outermost circle always did its own thing more than the rest of Eden, he says. And it only made sense to be as far as possible from the center if we were fighting its policies. So, as the rebellion grew, everyone who was sympathetic wound up here. First, they came from other circles to meet and organize. But later, when it became an open rebellion, many relocated permanently here. We have a mix of people from all circles. When the fighting started, we evacuated even more people out here, non-combatants and children. Even when the fighting was heaviest, we managed to keep the green shirts out of the circle. We kept our people safe.
Sounds like you've done a good job, I say, reluctant to praise him.
I had a lot of help. Flint, you know him, of course, leader of the underground, was the liaison of the second children. And since I'd had more contact with the inner circles, I represented the rebels who originated there. After Flint was killed in the fighting, I took over some of his roles, too.
Flint died? I ask, with truly mixed emotions. He tortured me, tortured Lark. But it was all in the name of protecting the second children he loved so loyally. I disagreed with his methods, but his intentions were good. I'm sorry to hear that, I say sincerely.
We didn't always see eye to eye, but he was a good man in his way, my father says. In the early days of conflict, we fought among ourselves as much as we fought the center. But since we moved out here, we've gotten along pretty well. He chuckles. I never would have dreamed that a rebellion is as much about diplomacy as it is about fighting. And now the fighting has stopped? I ask, as he takes me to one of the armories scattered around the circle. It is filled with weapons, so that, in case of attack, every citizen can arm themselves quickly. For now, as soon as Chief Elena mastered the widespread enhanced mind control, there was no need. We lost a lot of our best fighters then. But strangely, the people who came from the outer circles proved to be more resilient to the mind control than the inner circle elites. No one quite knows why.
Maybe it's because out here, in a circle of poverty and crime, they always have to be on guard. Someone is always trying to cheat them, or take something from them, or hurt them. So when the attack came from their own heads, they were more braced for it. They wouldn't fall for things as easily as the soft inner circle people.
We were soft, Dad says. Soft. And blind. And selfish. I knew, in theory, that there had been poverty out here. It was shameful in a society like ours. And it could have been corrected so easily. But like every other elite, I had my own concerns, and didn't really care. Same with Chief Elena getting increasingly out of control. We all saw it, but it didn't really affect us, so we ignored it. I'm ashamed, Rowan.
He gulps and stops walking.
I'm so ashamed of everything I did. I'm going to spend the rest of my life trying to make up for it all. I know I never will. But I'd give my life if it helped make amends for the person I used to be. It's just,
And I don't mean this as an excuse, just an analysis of human nature. It's so easy to do the easy things. You know what I mean? To go along. To let your money and power count for everything. And not really care about anyone but yourself. I fell into that trap. Now I know better.
He takes me by the hands.
I'm not going to ask you to forgive me, Rowan. I just want you to know that I'm trying to make things better.
You got the second children out of the center, I say, letting my hands stay in his, but limply. Part of me wants to cry, to forgive him and hug him, and be happy that I finally have the kind of dad I always wished I had. Another part, though, thinks it's too late for that.
That goes a long way.
I couldn't get everyone out, though. Your friend, Ash's friend, the girl with the pale purple hair. She was in one of the cells. When I got the doors open, everyone else streamed out, and I directed them where to go. I didn't notice she wasn't with the others until we were almost out of the center. I tried to get back, but I was carrying two kids who were too weak to run, and by the time I got someone else to take them from me, the guards had been alerted, and there was no way to get back inside. I'm sorry, Rowan. I think she'd been drugged. I think that's why she didn't run out with the others.
That matches with what I saw the last time I saw Lark, sitting in her cell, with an utterly blank expression on her face. What if they wiped away her old memories? What if she has no idea who I am? What if she's dead? Because I know that Lark would have resisted the chief's attempts at control with her last breath.
Do you know what happened to her? I ask. He shakes his head sadly.
My first task had to be getting all of the second children to safety. And I was hunted myself. I only survived by hiding in the outer circle. They don't like outsiders, but the second children told them how I'd helped them, and they decided to trust me. And gradually, the other few elites who have joined our cause. Once the fighting started, communication between the circles was difficult. We would smuggle out Flame's disruptors, but I'd no idea who was getting them. Evidently, it was your friend, Lachlan. I've heard all about him, you know, and I have to say, I approve.
Not that I need your approval, and I don't even know exactly what Lachlan and I are in the first place to be approved of, but how did you hear about him?
From Flame, and the girl who wants to marry him.
My eyebrows shoot up.
I mean Rainbow, my dad says with a laugh. Don't worry, it's good to have a little competition. And of course, his brother told me all about him. He sounds like an incredibly brave, resourceful, dedicated young man.
Wait, Rook is here? I ask excitedly. Where is he? Can I see him?
I love that big lug of a guy who joined the Green Shirts just so he could get inside the system and protect his second child brother. It's nice to have a man who is so big and strong and well-armed on your side. He must be a real asset to the rebels. I'm guessing he's probably stationed on the border between circles, with a giant gun, ready to fight off any attackers.
Dad leads me to a big building, painted in pale spring green, decorated with multicolored flowers, made from little handprints dipped in paint. When he opens the door, I see Rook on all fours, a bunch of yellow yarn on his head, roaring and batting at giggling children with his paws.
Rook fit in immediately as Iris is second in command in the nursery, Dad says with a wry grin.
I can see where Lachlan gets it, I mutter as I walk in, remembering the way the children of the underground used to swarm over Lachlan.
Rook breaks off mid-roar when he sees me. He stands up, his woolly mane ridiculously skewed, and gapes at me before bellowing, "You're alive!" and sweeping me off my feet to whirl me around in a dizzying hug.
I can't believe it! Does Lachlan know?
Ow! Easy on the ribs! I say breathlessly. He puts me down with an embarrassed grin, and the kids who are gathering around us start to giggle. He knows, and he's here. He made it across the desert.
Rook looks amazed.
And he came back? Did he find a way to get other people out? We've lost so many people in the attempt, but if he managed it...
I shake my head. He just barely made it, and almost died when he reached the other side. I don't think anyone else could have done it, but you know him. When I saw him there, he was so dehydrated.
Wait, you were there too? In the outside?
I tell him a quick version of everything that happened. I'm not sure if the children should be listening. Some are second children I remember from the underground. Some are strangers. But all are too young to shoulder adult worries. But then I think, even if we fail, maybe my story will plant a seed in them. Maybe it will be the next generation that breaks free. Rainbow has come in from her chores, and lords our friendship over the other children like a little queen. She commandeers my hand, then my lap, and as more children come in and demand to hear the story from the beginning, she takes over the narration. After a while, Iris comes over to chase them away. Enough chit-chat, it's time for play. Life can't be all serious, even out here. They obey her instantly. And I see that her matronly role hasn't changed much from the underground, just expanded. She cares for more kids and feeds more people. They've been playing what Rainbow calls fire and boom. They reenact the attack on the underground. At first, she made all of the Inner Circle refugee kids be the green shirts, but I eventually convinced her that wasn't fair. And they play escape, which is like tag, but they call the person who is it the chief. And if she tags them, they have to do what she says and help her hunt the others. But look at that.
It takes me a while to figure out what the children are playing now. After a moment, though, I realize that they are playing out my story. Rainbow is me, of course. She pantomimes waking up in the outside living world. Her look of amazement is heart-rendingly realistic. Then the kids jump to Lachlan's desert crossing, with all of the boys vying to be Lachlan. Rainbow wants to play this part, too, but then realizes that another little girl will then take over as me, so she grudgingly consents to let a gangly red-haired boy take the role of Lachlan. The boy staggers dramatically, and when he gets across the make-believe desert, there's a scene of romantic reunion, such as only a 9-year-old can create. I laugh at their antics, but make sure they don't hear. They are taking it very seriously, and I don't want Rainbow to be offended. I'm glad you gave them another story, Iris tells me. Meanwhile, Rook has gone in to play the part of the nanosand. He grabs them by their ankles and slides them backward across the slippery floor, while they squeal in mock terror. I know reenactment is a way that kids deal with trauma, but frankly, it was getting a little rough on me having to see the attack over and over again in miniature form. This is at least hopeful. I watch them until late afternoon. Then I'm shown to a small private room where I can wash up and relax a bit before the communal dinner. I splash cold water on my face, marveling that even the water here is different. Water is water, some might say, but in the wilderness, it is more complex. Flowing from deep underground, bubbling up in clear springs. This Eden water has the same molecules, but it tastes different somehow. Too pure, artificial and flat, just like everything else here. There's no bed, but a cushion on the floor provides a comfortable resting spot as I look through my backpack. I cuddle my childhood toy, Benjamin Bananas, a chimpanzee rubbed almost bare with years of love. There are a few articles of clothing, a hair clip, and some, but not all of my art supplies. There's paper, ink, erasers, but my sketch pencils, charcoals, and chalk are gone. I imagine Ash might have given them to the children. It must have been hard to keep them occupied in a rebel zone. I'm glad if my art supplies can keep their minds off the troubles for a while. Then, In the few moments of respite before I rejoin the others, I flip through the slim, small notebook my mother once found hidden in the walls of our unique stone house. The house that had once belonged to Aaron Elbaz. I read through his confession. He makes no apology for his actions. Despising and distrusting humanity, despairing of its inability to stop its headlong rush to self-destruction, he decided the best course of action was to wipe out most of it and start anew. He created Ecopan to run things after his death, to control mankind and continue the work of restoring and protecting the environment. He saved the Earth from humanity, but at what terrible cost? I come to the end, which is actually halfway through what had once been the original notebook. I can tell that the last pages had been torn out. Aaron affixed his signature to the last remaining page. I wonder what those missing pages might have said. He confessed to mass murder without shame. What else could he have written that was so bad he couldn't risk letting future generations read it? Looking closer, I notice for the first time that there are faint etchings in the back cover. This manuscript was handwritten. Turning the inside back cover at different angles to the light, I realize that these barely perceptible indentations must be the marks of whatever he wrote on the last page. The lines are too faint to read. But what if... I dig through my art supplies, in case I missed something. But no. Every pencil, chalk, and charcoal that might have helped is gone. I want to dust the last page, to bring the etchings into sharper relief. But all I can find is a minuscule crumb of red chalk dust, neglected by whoever took my things. Curious, I crumble that bit over a tiny section of the back cover, pat it down lightly, and then blow it away. I still have to angle the page and squint to make anything out, but when I do, I'm no less curious. "The Heart of Ecopan," it reads. Then someone knocks at my door, calling me to dinner, and I decide this is a mystery to solve later. Tonight, or in the morning, I'll ask Rainbow if she has any chalks. Then maybe I'll find out if Ecopan is less heartless than I believe. "They're having a little party in your honor," Iris tells me as we walk in together. "Nothing fancy, we don't have much. But there will be some musicians, and an acrobat, and..." Yawn. "Be quiet, Yarrow," I tell her in no uncertain terms. "Oh wow, an acrobat. Now that's what I call a party." "I won't have you disparage my friends," I tell her. "Oh, I love your friends. I just hate their parties. Can't you think about anything else? Something helpful, maybe? Seriously, why do I have to be stuck in the brain of such an idiot? This isn't the time, Yarrow," I hiss to her in my mind. "Your party girl ways won't help the rebels out of this mess." "Oh, no? Like I helped the time we snuck out to that killer party at Tidal?" I remember, or I know from Yarrow's memories, how we partied at that exotic water-themed club. I remember the water slide, nearly drowning, and escape from the green shirts. "There's nothing at that party that will help us," I tell her. She sighs, and I feel her exasperation with me. "Before the party, you dolt! How did we escape from Oaks in the first place?" My eyes light up, and I say excitedly, "The Chambers of Mysteries!" The temple connects to Oaks, I explain, once I've gathered everyone together. I tell Lachlan, Ash, Mom, Dad, Flame, and Angel. I don't want to get anyone else's hopes up yet. Dinner and the party are on hold. "The sisters and brothers are some of our teachers," I go on, "and the school has a close relationship with the temple. The main part of the temple is guarded. Just by the brothers, of course. And they couldn't put up much of a fight, but they would be enough to cry a warning. If you approach from the school, though, that way should be clear. At most, there might be one sleepy attendant." Flame looks impatient.
But why would we want to go to the temple?
I tell them how, what feels like a lifetime ago, my Oaks friends and I broke into the temple as a way to sneak out of Oaks and go to a fabulous party. It seems so shallow now, and thinking of the girl I was, I blush. We passed through the Sky Hall, and I found the Chambers of Mysteries. I described to them the honeycomb of rooms, dozens of connected hexagons, each room with 6 doors, each leading to another exactly like it. Most were empty, but one held something very interesting.
A bunch of superstitious nonsense, Flame grumbles.
Until I tell her what I found in one of the rooms. I was separated from the others, and in one of the 6-sided chambers, I found a bowl of dirt. Real, fertile dirt.
Were there any seeds?
Flame asks tersely. No, I say hesitantly. But there were a lot of rooms, and I only saw a few of them. If there is dirt from the outside living world, held as a relic, mightn't there be seeds too?
It is possible, Flame admits. But the odds are pretty slim.
Think about it, though, Lachlan says. Someone in the center had to have access to a seed in order to access a system in the first place, to change the programming, right? So there has to be a collection of seeds somewhere. If we know that there are relics from the outside, guarded by the temple sisters and brothers, it is reasonable to think there might be seeds there.
Sure, Flame agrees. Or there might have been one seed, just one, and Chief Elena already used it to reset the programming.
I cross my arms. Do you have any other ideas?
Well, no, she admits. But how would we get inside? As you say, the brothers might not be fighters, but there are surely enough of them in the main temple to raise an alarm.
We can't go through the street entrance, and Oaks is a closed school with security. It's not like we can just walk on the grounds and start poking around.
My father concurs.
We don't have the forces to make a large-scale attack. Whatever we do, it has to be a precision maneuver, in and out with no one the wiser.
And ideally, without loss of life, Angel adds. They might be greenshirts, or center officials, and inner circle elites, but they are also our neighbors. It's not their fault they're being controlled.
We are all silent for a moment. Then, there is one way. I bite my lower lip. Maybe.
You can't pose as a student, Lachlan says. They'll know who you are in a second.
If I tried to pass as an Oak student, they would. But not necessarily if I came from a different school.
Flame, you can still do fake temporary lenses, right?
Give me an identity that stands up for a few hours?
Sure, but center elites pay top dollar to have their precious princesses protected. You can't just saunter into the school.
One day of the month I can. And so can the rest of us. One evening a month, there was a party on the grounds for alumni, parents, and for kids from other schools who were hoping to transfer to Oaks. Security is light.
It's possible, my mom says. But only one day of the month?
We might not be able to hold out that long.
When is the next one?
I've been living by moon cycles and seasons for the last few months. I have no idea what the date is today. But I know the open party is always on the same day of the month.
I tell them when that is.
Flame sighs.
Figures.
What?
I ask.
Is it almost a month away?
Even worse, she says. It's tonight.
We debate for a furious few moments, with the end result being that there is no way we can possibly get an equipped team together in time. But they're just as certain we can't wait another month. By then, the center will have made their final attack, and the outermost circle will be overrun.
It's impossible, Flame says at last, as she gathers up her things and heads for the door. Absolutely impossible, and completely bicking insane.
She tosses her final words over her shoulder as she leaves. I'll have my part ready in 2 hours. You all better do the same, because I'm going to be seriously annoyed if I pull a miracle out of my pocket and you guys don't come through too.
Mom and I look at each other and, despite the seriousness of the situation, can't quite stifle a laugh.
Now we just have to form the team.
I think we have them right here,
Lachlan says.
No,
Mom and I say simultaneously. Mira and Carnelian got dragged into this. They don't know the city, the security, anything about our ways. We can't let them put themselves in danger.
Rowan, Mira says very seriously, how can you insult me like that? And Carnelian too. We weren't dragged. We jumped. We know the risks, and we both think the reward is worth any danger we might face.
We had plenty of chances to back out, to go home, and we didn't take them.
Much as I hate putting anyone at risk, Lachlan begins.
Besides yourself, I say in a low aside. It might be our best bet to have them along. Angel, you said there was a spy in your group recently, right?
She nods.
Someone we trusted a great deal.
And I know all of the rebel groups are organized in separate cells, so that if one person is captured or compromised, the whole organization can't be brought down.
This is very risky, and if the center finds out what we're after, they'll keep it under closer guard.
We only have a chance now, because they have no idea we know that we need a seed to access the system. The people in this room are trustworthy.
I can't help meeting my father's eyes. I see lingering shame there, and determination not to let his family down again.
So I think the mission to get the seed should only involve the people in this room. It will be a quick infiltration. Rowan for knowledge of the school grounds and procedures, some to go into the temple, some to serve as a distraction, and all of us to fight our way out if necessary. But if all goes according to plan, we'll be in and out with no one having any idea we're not prospective students and their families.
My father agrees.
Then we can take more time to plan the attack on the center itself. That would be absolutely impossible to do with a few hours' notice. That will require our most elite forces, our best weapons, days of scenario training and drills. It will be the most dangerous and most important thing we've ever done. We'll be lucky if we're ready for that part of the operation in 2 weeks.
After frantic preparations, we have our fake lenses that, when scanned, identify Mira, Carnelian, Angel, Lachlan, Ash, and I as students in a second circle school, who hope to get accepted to Oaks for their final year of school. Mom, Dad, and Flame are posing as parents. The identities won't withstand intense scrutiny, but if we can avoid detection on the way there, they won't have to. Oaks prides itself on being for a special, elite kind of person, and as long as we carry ourselves like we belong, in fact, like we are better than everyone else, we will probably be admitted without much inspection. I question the wisdom of bringing Pearl along. As one of the most notorious students Oaks ever had, there's a definite risk of her being recognized. I don't want to spoil her new life here by revealing her identity, but she is determined to come with us. After talking it over with Lachlan, we decide she should come. Her retinal scans within the school should still show her as Pearl, even if her identity in the rest of Eden has changed. The school has its own security system. It might be useful to have a set of eyes that can magically open any door in the school. Though I'm nervous about the situation, I make sure her outfit includes a heavy veil, which seems to be fashionable at the moment. With her face hidden, that should be enough. At the last moment, I slip Erin's notebook underneath my clothes. That phrase, Heart of Ecopan, echoes in my head with a low-key buzzing. Somehow, I can't leave the notebook behind. We move along underground tunnels, alleys, and secret passages through buildings and basements. The journey takes until nightfall. The party starts in the afternoon, I tell them. That's mostly for the older alumni. They have a few caffeinated cocktails and talk about old times. Then once night falls, the younger set takes over with a special themed party. I wonder what it will be this year. They can be pretty strict at Oaks, but the students have found plenty of ways of circumventing that. On alumni nights, it's a lot easier. There's so much coming and going that the teachers can't keep track of the students. And they don't want to make the school look bad by criticizing or punishing their own students in front of parents or prospective applicants. So as long as the kids keep out of sight, it can be the most wild night of the month.
So they won't even notice us? Mira asks. Good. I don't want anyone looking at me.
Somehow I get the feeling she isn't just talking about the success of our mission, and I ask her about it.
Are you kidding? She says. Look at me! I look like a freak!
She's wearing a dress of incredibly bright yellow and orange faux feathers that contrasts beautifully with her dark skin. It is short in the front, but trails down longer in the back. Her hair has been tamed beneath a chic little cap that looks like a bird in flight. Tendrils of fluffy marabou twine from her arms, suggesting the new feathers of a fledgling.
You look absolutely adorable, I gush.
There are going to be girls copying your outfit in the next few weeks.
I look like I just tumbled out of a nest, she grumbles.
People are going to go blind looking at me. I know colors aren't very loud in Harmonia, I tell her, but here, people really like to stand out.
Yeah, Mira, Carnelian says. You'll blend in by standing out.
Still, she looks down at her garish clothes in disdain, and I know she is longing for the moss-dyed linens of home. Carnelian is pulling at the high, stiff collar of his pinstriped ensemble, rubbing his wrists where the material scratches. I've taken wild animals and lured them into a cage. We don't meet any trouble on the way, which my dad says is surprising in itself. I half thought we wouldn't make it this far.
The eternal pessimist, Mom says, with grumbling affection.
It is so strange to see them together. It is like tragedy and hardship have somehow wiped out all past mistakes and grievances and let them get a fresh start. Like Pearl with her wiped brain, they have a clean slate.
It is strange, though, Lachlan muses, as we reach the inner circles, the place where he has been operating for the past 3 months. Usually there is a checkpoint right there, across the bridge. I worried it might be tricky to evade, but it is unmanned.
I feel a strange buzzing in my head as we pass through.
I guess this is just our lucky day, Angel says.
She seems to be the most hopeful of all of us, and gives a little twirl as we sneak along. The rebels keep a storehouse of disguises for the times they have to move in other circles, and from the choices, Angel selected an ethereal cream-colored dress in a princess cut, so simple in style, unadorned, except for a single artificial rose in her décolletage. The rose, too, is cream, with the faintest hint of pink in the center, spreading out like a blush. A silver headband holds a gauzy half-veil that she has pushed back over her hair now. Later, when we get to Oaks, she'll put it down. I made sure of this. It would be bad on so many levels if she got recognized. Still, I don't want to tell her why. Such a difference between the old Pearl and this new Angel. It is almost impossible to believe that the cruel girl who dominated the school and this sweet, resourceful person are one in the same. It is at that moment, when I've paused to admire the new Pearl, that I see her hand slip into my brother's. Not just for a moment, not just in temporary reassurance. There is a kind of possession there, a permanence. I can't help but gasp.
You too? You're...
They see me staring at their linked hands. Ash and Angel exchange looks.
Well...
Ash begins and flushes, We're kind of... I mean... My brother was never the most eloquent at bravely expressing his emotions for women, but his flustered face tells me everything. Angel confirms it more succinctly. When I joined this rebel cell and met him, he seemed so familiar. Like I knew his face well. I thought maybe we'd known each other before I lost my memory, but he says no, we never met. Still, when I look at his face, I feel... She breaks off, and I wonder how she was going to finish the sentence. Instead, she just smiles at him, her eyes full of love. We started dating a while ago, and so far so good. It is a bright moment of joy in the middle of incredible tension, and I hug first Ash, then Angel. A little later, when she and I are walking a bit apart from the others, Angel confides in me. Before, when I stop myself, I was going to say something I know Ash wouldn't like, but I know you would understand. When I first saw his face, I felt the strangest sensation, like I had something to make up for, an obligation to make him happy, like I had hurt him and had to make it better. Isn't that silly? And of course, no guy wants to know that your feelings for him started out as some kind of guilty sense of obligation. Not very romantic, right? But after I got to know him, the sensation faded. And now, I just love him, purely and completely. You look so much like him. I felt a flash of it when I first saw you. Are you sure we haven't met? You acted odd when you first saw me. Part of me still feels like I should tell her. But now, when everyone has to be highly focused, is not the time to distract her with the story of her life. After we finish this, there are some things I want to talk about, I tell her vaguely. We come to the point where we have to leave the protective hiding places and proceed the rest of the way in the open city streets of the Inner Circles. Just be confident, a little arrogant, I advise the ones posing as students. Laugh with us, and look scornfully at everything and anyone who isn't part of your group. I know you'll want to duck your head, Lachlan says, or slink near the wall so no one will notice you, but that's the worst thing you can do. Keep your head high, and look like you own the world, or at least the city. I remember how to turn on the act. No, that's me, Yarrow chimes in. You're still the timid girl who is more comfortable behind walls. Whatever, as long as it gets the job done. Ash is his old schoolboy persona, a bit nerdy, not extroverted, but he'll obviously look like he belongs. Lachlan, of course, is used to masquerading as everything from a blind outer circle beggar to an inner circle elite, so he looks fine. Mom and Dad look just like old times, when I'd see them getting ready to go out to one of his hospital's dinners or her center functions. Conservatively well-dressed, comfortable with their place in the universe. Mira is putting on a bold face, but I think we'll carry her through the night. I have confidence that she can do anything. Carnelian looks uncomfortable, but I remind him that people will mostly be looking at the girls anyway. In a party like this, we'll circle each other, judge each other, vie for dominance, I explain. Like a wolf pack, Carnelian says. Exactly, I tell him. You've studied wolves, so you'll do fine. So, ears forward, tail up, and let's be the alpha wolves at this party. We did it, Angel squeals, and I shush her. Don't look glad, look bored and superior, I remind her. Our group, split up to be less conspicuous, has made it into Oaks. Instantly, Angel seems to transform. She seems taller, more elegant, her neck angling to show off the most lovely contours of her face as she looks with well-bred disdain on the partygoers. I gulp in amazement. She has become Pearl. Then the illusion shatters, as the corners of her mouth tremble with the threat of a giggle.
Like that?
She asks. I never knew I was that good of an actress. It is perfect, I say. Too perfect. Frighteningly perfect. For a moment, every part of me yearns to defer to her as I used to, back when she was the queen of the school. I adjust her veil, making sure it covers everything but her lips. It doesn't completely hide her, but it is dark now. The party illuminated by fairy lights and fake fire torches, and I don't think anyone will look at her that closely. If all goes well, we shouldn't be here more than a half hour. Ash, Mom, Mira, and Carnelian will head to the outer, public portion of the temple. They will be acting as sentries, ready to tackle anyone who tries to enter. Low-key, trustworthy-looking Ash will be their point man, ready to convince anyone who comes that they have an innocent reason to be there, and that no one should go any deeper into the temple. They are to engage as a last resort, and are mostly there to let the four in the vanguard know if anyone is coming for them. The rest of us are going into the inner sanctum of the temple, the roofless sky hall, and the sacred honeycomb of rooms that is the Chambers of Mysteries. Even though I've been there before, that won't be much help. I can only clearly recall the way through the outer area of the sky hall. Once I got to the hexagonal rooms, it all looked the same, and I have no memory of the route I took. We'll have to rely on trial and error. With so many people searching, though, it shouldn't take long. Only some of us are armed, though. We weren't sure about security at the entrance to Oaks, and figured that if the armed members were caught, at least the rest of us could get through and try to continue the mission. Angel, who more and more I want to call Pearl, now that we are back in our old haunts, and I are, out of the group, the ones best able to look like arrogant inner circle elites. We mingle with the crowd, checking for any overt signs of danger, while the others make their way into position. We can't all go that way at once. It would be too obvious. We'll join them in a moment. If our lenses have set off a silent alarm, or if any center officials or security show up for a random check, Angel and I will be the first to spot them. We all have tiny, hidden earbuds to communicate with each other. They're so sensitive that they can pick up our speech as well as transmit the signal, so we don't need a separate microphone. At the first sign of trouble, I'll sound the alarm. Or, I think grimly, take care of it myself. After a few moments, we judge it is time to head into the temple with the others. But I'm anxious. What if I'm wrong, and there are no seeds here? Was it foolish to put all of us at so much risk over what is essentially a hunch? It would make sense if they had seeds in the Chambers of Mysteries, and other relics from the earth they all thought had perished. But it is by no means a sure thing. I have to admit that the most likely scenario is that we will come out of the temple shaking our heads, and will have made this dangerous journey for nothing.
I can't believe people live like this, Angel says. So much waste, so much effort put into things that don't matter, like clothes, appearance. I know they're forced into compliance by the chief's mind control, but they were like this before, weren't they?
I nod, thinking I was right not to tell her. She'd be aghast at the person she used to be, even if it wasn't her fault. I don't even know how heavily these people are being controlled, I say. Lachlan told me that they focus most of the signal from the mid-circles outward. In here, people are controlled by other means. Money, comfort, striving to be more fashionable and popular than your neighbors. I look at the elaborate shallowness all around me. The inner circle elites do a good job of controlling themselves, numbing themselves to the problems around them.
It's disgusting, she says, and her lip curls into a sneer as we walk toward the temple.
That one simple expression is our undoing. Most of Angel's face is hidden, but that sneer is telltale. Two girls are walking by, their elaborate floppy hats drooping over half their faces, barely sparing us a glance. Then one of them stops and grabs the other by the arm, jerking her to a halt, too.
Hello,
Angel says affably.
Pearl?
Says an incredulous voice. It's Lynx. Then the other pushes back the brim of her hat and speaks.
No picking way! It is her!
It's Copper.
Oh, Pick. Now that we've been spotted, it will be too dangerous for us to follow the others into the temple. We'll have to stay out here.
No one else has recognized us before now. Pearl is so unlike her usual self, and I'm more or less in disguise too. They knew me with bleached hair, and now it is back to its true, lustrous dark hue. I'm wearing a snakeskin bodysuit, and the hollow glasses that are fashionable at the moment. The projection is a scaled pattern in glittering black and gold that makes it look like I have a serpent's slit eyes. I can see clearly out, but no one can see my eyes. Now Copper and Lynx barely look at me. They appear uncertain, almost cringing, their eyes darting around the room warily, and at first I think they're planning to turn us in. In a moment, though, I realize it is their old fear of Pearl returning, that nervous deference and desire to stay in her good graces. I silently will Pearl to speak.
We didn't think we'd ever see you again, Copper says uneasily. You're still registered as a student, but the faculty won't say... We heard your family lost all its money, Lynx interjects.
I'm sorry, we really didn't think you'd be back.
Copper looks miserable and unsure.
She took your room, threw out half of your stuff. We told her to wait and see, but...
She said you'd never be back. She said you were finished.
She said you had a baby. That you were a synth mesk addict.
They are talking in lightning-fast patter, as if getting in a certain number of words would make everything okay. Beside me, Angel is looking confused, but has wisely decided not to say anything yet.
Look, we didn't have anything to do with it. If you're really back, you better talk to her.
Finally, Angel speaks.
Talk to who?
Why, the one who took your place. Lark, of course.
It feels like the deafened silence after an explosion. Voices around me grow indistinct and then fade away entirely. The edges of the room blur. She's here.
Did I hear my name?
I hear the sweetest voice in the world say. I turn and see a lilac-haired goddess. A goddess who resembles Lark. But it can't be. This girl is all the things Lark despised. Her hair looks like a team spent all afternoon coloring and styling it. Like each single strand was dyed a unique color, so that when she moved, her hair looked like a cascade of wildflowers blowing in the breeze on a sunny day. Her clothes are exquisite. Not overdone and overblown like so many people's here. Deep, low-cut violet velvet hugs her curves. Curves which are decidedly more exaggerated than they were a scant 3 months ago. The dress is all that single color, with no sparkles or embellishments. Sleeveless, with a high slit to the thigh, it leaves a lot of skin exposed. She doesn't wear a single piece of jewelry. All of her ornaments are on her skin. They aren't tattoos, as I thought at first glance. It's not a hologram either, because it seems to be not just on, but in her skin. Maybe it is some kind of paint, but it isn't something anyone was using when I left. In any case, designs seem to flow across her skin as if they were alive. Fish swim sinuously across, and apparently through, her flesh, as if she were a living aquarium. Stunning reef creatures in jewel tones dance playfully over her exposed skin, while a sinuous eel wraps itself around her leg, starting at her ankle, disappearing between her thighs. She is a living work of art. A masterpiece. But her face. It is that which makes me question whether this is really my own Lark. Her face is different. Not just her expression, but the contours, altered in subtle ways. Objectively, it makes her more beautiful. Her face is perfectly symmetrical now, her eyes a little bigger, her nose just a fraction smaller. Her mouth, naturally full and curvy, is now positively lush. The planes of her face, the angles of her cheekbones and jaw, have all changed in subtle ways. It's like someone tried to make a perfect copy of Lark. Not an exact copy, but to make her perfect. It is horrible. But after the quickest glance, I know without a doubt that it is truly Lark. Despite those changes, I can tell from more subtle cues, the way she moves her hands, the fresh-cut flower smell of her skin, that this is really her. She's looking at Pearl, obviously recognizing her. But I am the one who breathes her name. Lark. Her eyes dart instantly from Pearl to me, and for one unguarded instant, I see her perfect composure falter. Then it is back, and she says my name, gasps it with surprise and apparent joy, and suddenly her arms are around me, my face is in her hair. For a moment, I stand immobile. I don't know what to think. How can she be here? The last I saw her, she was a prisoner, sitting unresponsive in a cell. I didn't know if she was drugged, or if she'd had her brain wiped clean. I suspected the worst. That she was left to a horrible fate of experimentation, resisting all she could, being cruelly conquered, and when there was nothing left of her, tossed aside to a gutter or grave. Frantically, I try to think of an optimistic explanation. Maybe without me around, Chief Elena had no reason to keep Lark. Maybe it was mostly to torture me, and with me presumably blown up, Lark just wasn't any fun anymore. The Chief could have returned Lark to her parents, perhaps with selective parts of her memory wiped, and they just kept her enrolled in Oaks. But no, I make myself realize, even as Lark rests warm against my body, it can never be that easy. If Chief Elena let Lark live, it has to be for some malicious purpose. With me, and with Pearl, she wanted to create the perfect citizens in the intense crucible of an elite private school. And she wanted to see how far she could alter someone's mind before they went insane. Lark has to be another victim of her sick experiments. I tell myself to be ready for anything. Lark could have been reprogrammed in any way. When I was Yarrow, I had no real memory of my past. I acted in ways I now find abhorrent. Lark might be like that. At least she knows who I am. I'm surprised the Chief didn't wipe all memory of me. But then, I know that Lark's brain chemistry makes her hard to program. She has epilepsy, and every time she has a seizure, the electrical activity in her brain resets at least some of whatever mind control is being used on her. I remember that her lenses malfunctioned, and most of the time, she couldn't be tracked. Maybe she managed to fight the Chief's mind manipulation. Only one thing is for certain. As of this moment, my mission has changed. Let the others focus on getting the seed, I think, as I finally let my arms twine around her. My main objective right now is to rescue Lark. "Did you come for me?" she whispers into my ear, her breath warm and ticklish. Without the slightest hesitation, I say, "Did you imagine I'd let you go?" I can't trust her with the truth until I know more about what happened to her. Maybe she's free, under no control, and ready to be an ally. Maybe she's a mind slave, and I'll have to rescue her against her will, and she won't be her old self until Flame surgically disconnects the lenses and whatever else the center might have in her head. She disengages from my hug, looking smugly satisfied. Then she turns her attention to Pearl. I'm surprised you have the nerve to show your face here. She turns and whispers something into Copper's ear, and the girls giggle together while Pearl blushes.